All right, so today we're continuing our journey in the heart of the matter. This is going to be part 55. And I know some people have contacted me recently if they've gone through some of the older ones, like the beginning ones, where I said things like, well, I don't know how many parts this is going to take. It might take 15 or 20. And, well, who knew? I didn't know. At that point, I don't think I'd ever done anything more than 6 or 7. You know, and now we have lots of them that are 13 or 11 or 14 parts, whatever. But this was by far the longest one I'd ever done once we got past 7 or 8 or 9. So who knew? So we're up to 55, part 55. And before we get into 55, I want to take a minute just to kind of give us some perspective on where we are in the book of Ephesians, okay? Now, we've been reading a lot of this book. A lot of this, it's not even a book, it's a letter, okay? We've been reading a lot of this epistle or this a letter to the Ephesians. And in reading it, I sometimes have not made enough of an emphasis that we're dealing with heart issues because the word heart was not in every verse or everywhere in the chapter. But everything we've been talking about has all been about the state or the focus of what was going on in our heart. All right, we started off in chapter 2 and we talked a lot about this idea of renewing the man, that becoming this renewed man through the idea that understanding in the beginning that we were dead in our trespasses because we once walked according to the world and Hasatan. We understood that in this state we lived in our lusts and of our flesh and doing the desires of the flesh. That's clearly a heart issue. Okay, and as we're going through the chapter, we needed to understand that we were never to forget that we were once Gentiles without Messiah, excluded from the citizenship of Israel. We were strangers to the covenants. But now in Messiah, we're brought together through his blood. This is going through chapter 2. And then at the end of chapter 2, we were told that we were no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens because what? Because we had a change of heart. And that change of heart changed our behaviors, our actions, our habits, and our destiny ultimately. Okay? So this is all about the heart. And then we got into chapter 3, and as we were going forward, and in chapter 3, we were talking a lot about the other things that were going on in continuing there. Because of this, we understood that there was a secret that was being administered. We were supposed to see that there was a secret that had been hidden. What was that secret? That if there was a heart change, Gentiles and Israelites could then become one under Messiah as fully in the Commonwealth of Israel. And we went through chapter 3 and we worked our way down that it said, even in verse 17, it says, that Messiah might dwell in your hearts through belief, having become rooted and grounded in love. That was the whole point of all of chapter 2 and all of chapter 3, was to get us to that place that the Messiah might dwell in our hearts. And then we talked about what that meant in a much more full understanding, meaning the Torah, the truth, all that Messiah is would dwell in our hearts. We also know that Elohim is love, and Messiah being a part of Elohim is love. So love needed to dwell in our hearts. All of these things. And so that was really what was going on. In order that you might be strengthened to firmly grasp with all the set apart ones, what is the width, the length, the depth, and the height, etc., to know the love of Messiah. And then we got into chapter 4, where we were seeing this now play out in leadership. He's saying all of this is only going to work with guidance and direction and discipleship. And so we find out that there was, at least in the way that Paul understood it, there was these different positions of leadership. He understood them to be emissaries and prophets and evangelists and shepherds and teachers whose job it was to help us get our hearts right, basically. That's the job, to work and disciple, to have us have the same heart as Yeshua. Like, you know, David's one of the only ones that you see, if not the only one, where it says that he had a heart like unto Abba, like unto Yahweh. And so the whole goal here is to become Yeshua-like, to have that same heart, the heart like Yeshua's, the mind of Yeshua. Now, we're not in Philippians, but we know in Philippians 2:5, it says, let this mind be in you. Because if we're thinking a certain way, eventually our emotions will get attached to those thoughts, which then manifest into actions, which lead eventually into development of habits, which lead to a ultimate destiny. And so here we went through chapter 4, going through these things, and then we now are in chapter 5, and as we go through this whole process of chapter 4, you know, chapter 4 then reminds us that this leadership that was supposed to be in place was supposed to be there until we all come to the unity of the belief and of the knowledge of the Son of Elohim to a perfect man. Now, we're not there yet, obviously. So the encouragement was that there still must then be this leadership out there available to you. Because there were supposed to be, he says, look, he says, he himself gave some to be until, verse 11 says he gave some to be, and then it says in verse 13, until. So I believe there's still some out there that are prepared, trained, and anointed, and appointed to do these roles. And I've said, then our job, your job, is to find those people and to get in to that covering, into that place of discipleship. And we're going to see a lot more discipleship wording as we continue through Ephesians and then into continuing. Now, so he lays this all out, and he says, look, all of this has a purpose in verse 17 so that you no longer walk in the Gentile mindset. Don't walk as Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. Because then if as your mind goes, then eventually your heart, then the actions, then the etc., right? He says, because they've been darkened in their understanding, etc. Now, he says in verse 19, they became callous. Again, that's a heart issue. They became callous, hard-hearted. And that callousness led to wrong decisions and wrong behaviors, etc. Their heart was in a wrong place. So now all of this leads us now to chapter 5. So chapter 5 in verse 1, he says, become then. See, become then is saying, because of everything I just told you, now I'm going to give you my encouragement. You just learned all of this stuff. You just heard all of this stuff. He's telling the Ephesians, and he said, become then imitators of Elohim as beloved children. He's saying, this is now what you're going to need to do. You need to become imitators. Become imitators of Elohim. Now, I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit. Become imitators of Elohim because this is how beloved children would act. Okay? He says, become then imitators of Elohim as beloved children. In other words, this is the way a beloved child would act. You would imitate your father. If you love your father, you would want to imitate your father. I've got children. My children are 11 and 12, actually 11 and 13, and soon to be 12 and 13. And my children, I promise you, imitate their mother and their father. And you, how many times has somebody said to you, oh, you're just like your mother, you're just like your father in some way? We do, we imitate. And he's telling us here, become imitators like children do. And you, now here's the problem. The problem is you have to set all the right examples. But see, here we know that we're imitating Elohim, who only sets the right examples. And so isn't that nice to know that we don't have to worry about the example being set, we just have to imitate it. Whereas as a parent, we have to be very aware that sometimes we're not setting a good example, and that also is imitated, our bad examples. So continuing now in verse 2, he says, and walk in love, as Messiah also has loved us, and gave himself for us a gift and an offering to Elohim for a sweet-smelling fragrance. So what we see here, hopefully, is that he's saying here, look, become imitators of Elohim as beloved children, in other words, in the way that they would act, as a beloved child, how that would be. He says, and I want you to do this in love as Messiah also loved us and gave himself for us a gift and an offering to Elohim for a sweet-smelling fragrance. Now, in 1 Corinthians 11, 1, you don't have to go there, but it says, you see Paul saying, become imitators of me as I also imitate Messiah. So he's saying, look at the things that I do. So now in verse 2 of chapter 5, we're being told, look at what Messiah did. Look at how he loved us. And we're to imitate those things. He said, walk in love. We could do a whole teaching, and maybe we will at some point, on this understanding of the word walk, but we're going to kind of get into it a little bit right now, but maybe we need even a whole teacher on, but the walk, or the word walk, is holech. Okay, that's where you get the Hebrew, or the understanding of halacha, okay, or the way that we walk. This is the guidelines, the direction on what is the appropriate way to walk. We call it halacha. What we do, how we do it, when we do it, why we do it, who we do it with or for, etc. This is your halacha, according to Scripture. And he says he wants you to holech, or to walk, in love. And we know that Elohim is love. We should also understand at this point that the Torah is his explanation to us on what love looks like in loving him and loving each other. It's the description of what that should look like. How do you do this? Okay, because most people out there are not teaching the how, just telling you that you need to do it. You need to love your Elohim or love God with all your heart, blah, 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 and love your neighbors yourself. Okay, that's great. How? What does that look like? Well, he's telling us here, become imitators of Elohim. He says, walk in love as Messiah loved us. Oh, okay, so now we can see a little bit more of this walking in love. He said, this is how Messiah loved us, through giving himself for us. This was a gift and an offering to Elohim for a sweet-smelling fragrance. So he did this. He loved us and gave himself for us, not for us, because it gave a sweet-smelling fragrance to Elohim. It pleased his Father. You see? It's not that he didn't love us and didn't care for us, but remember, he's doing everything he did, I do to please my Father. So that's the initial motivator. So that means that even if you don't really like me so much, you can still love me because it pleases your Creator. You following that? See, it's easy for you to love me if you actually care and like me and or have some sort of thing which says that you feel comfortable in my presence or whatever. You know, the things that make us friends with each other or attracted to each other on whatever level. But you see, Yeshua died also for the sinners and for everybody else. Why? Because it was a sweet-smelling fragrance to the Father. So he was motivated by doing what was pleasing because he says, look, he gave himself for us a gift and offering to Elohim. He did it for his Father. We are the beneficiaries of it, but he did it for his Father. I hope that makes some sense. Because that should now encourage you and free you up to understand, but I don't like so-and-so. It's not about you liking so-and-so. It's about you loving your Father and making yourself, and doing this as a gift and an offering to him. Because that's a sweet-smelling fragrance. See, but when we dig our heels in and we get all that bitterness going on and we don't want to love our enemies, we don't want to love our friends even, and our relatives, etc., then we're missing the whole point. Love them. Now, love them doesn't mean that you then go and immerse yourself in all of the things they're doing that you know you need to not be a part of. And that's where I think we get confused. Because people will say, well, you don't love me because you don't come over for Christmas, or you don't love me because you don't do this, or you don't love me. Well, that's your definition of love. That's not Yahweh's definition of love. Okay? When you stand there and say, no, honey, I'm doing this because I love you so that you see the example and you see the fruit and you see the integrity, that if I compromise, that doesn't help you. If I compromise, that doesn't help you at all. It's loving for me to stand strong and say, I'm sorry, but I can't come. I know you want me to come. I know you want me to participate in whatever it is that you want me to participate in that goes against Torah. But it's not loving for me to go and be codependent with you and enabling you. That's not loving. It's also not loving, though, to attack them, belittle them, and judge them, and all the other things that we do. Okay? There's a right way to do it. How do we know? You do it in the context of the fruit of Galatians 5:22. Okay? We do it in the context of the fruit of the Spirit. And so if I have to read that to you, I mean, I can read it to you, but this is really what we can do just to make sure that we understand. We do this in the context. So when you're loving someone, how do we do it? Well, we do it by being loving, joyful, peaceful, patient, kind, good, trustworthy, gentle, with self-control. If you can do it that way, even though you're still not doing what they want, that is expressing the walk in the way that Yeshua walked. That's the love. And he's telling you, become imitators of him. Become imitators of Elohim. Walk in love as Messiah also loved us and gave himself as a gift. He says, this is a gift and a sweet-smelling fragrance. Now, in John 8, in verse 12, we can go to John for a second. Hold your place here in Ephesians. But if you go to John Chapter 8, we're talking about this walk. So what does he mean to walk? What is he talking about? So in John 8, and we're going to go to verse 12. In John 8, verse 12, it says, therefore Yeshua spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who imitates me, he who follows me, shall by no means walk in darkness, but possess the light of life. So now we're being told exactly what's going on in Ephesians. If you imitate him, if you follow him, you will not only no longer walk in darkness, but now you're walking in light. And so that matches up very well with Ephesians chapter 5 here. Also in John chapter 12, we'll stay here in John chapter 12, and look at verse 35 and 36. Yeshua therefore said to them, "Yet a little while the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. And he who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light so that you become sons of light." These words Yeshua spoke and went off and was hidden from them. So then we have to have our definition of light. Well, we have a teaching that's called Yeshua, the light of the world. So we know Yeshua is light. Okay, because he already said here, "I am the light of the world." We read that in John 8:12. But we also understand, as he goes through this comparison of light and darkness, we've done this quite a bit in other teachings, that walking as the world walks and as Hasatan would have us, that's called darkness. By the way, we were told that in Ephesians chapter 2. When we told that in chapter 2, when it says, look, you were, verse 1, it says, "You were dead in trespasses and sin in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the ruler of the authority, the air of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience." This is the darkness. So what's the opposite of the darkness? The light. What is the light? Torah. The teachings and instructions from above. You walk in the Torah, you're walking in the light. So he says, look, if you're going to imitate me, if you're going to follow me, you're going to walk in the Torah. You're going to walk in the Torah. Now we get to verse 3. In verse 3, we're back to chapter 5 of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5. I know I got you bouncing around here. He says, "But whoring and all uncleanness or greed of gain, let it not even be named among you, as is proper among set apart ones." "Let it not even be named among you." In other words, let it not be how you are known to be. It's not just about people spreading rumors or saying things like, oh, you have to worry about every little thing. Look, people are going to say what people are going to say. But you have to understand that there are also going to be people that know different. But essentially, at some point, if you really are these things, you're going to be known to be those things. So let it not be known that you are this way, whoring and uncleanness and greedy gain, etc. Let it not be named among you that this person, that's their character, that's where their heart is. So it's not about going around shutting everybody up who's accusing. There are other people that need to be doing that for other reasons, because we shouldn't be accusing. But do not get for yourself a reputation where people know that you're this way. It shouldn't even be known about you. Let it not be how you are known to be. You need to be, you know, we're in a shameless society. Nobody cares what anybody thinks about anything they do. We need to actually be aware and be caring about what people think about us. Because after all, you claim to represent the king of the universe. And so people, I promise you, I absolutely promise you this. Once you tell people that you're Torah observant, once you start wearing your tzitzit, once you start standing up and saying, I'm not going to, you know, do Christmas or Easter, I'm not going to do Sunday, I'm not going to eat certain, whatever you do that lets somebody know that you're keeping things differently, they are now going to put the magnifying glass and spotlight on you. And they're going to look for every little bit of hypocrisy to accuse you of, to say, oh, you claim you're so righteous doing blah, 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 even if you never claim that, just because they're going to think that because you want to keep Torah. Oh, you think you're so righteous, but I know that you do this, this, and this. Remember, as soon as you declare to be of Yahweh, you're an ambassador. You represent him. He says, don't let it be known. Don't have a reputation. Don't let it be how people see you to be or know you to be. Because they're going to be like, oh, so that's what Torah observance looks like. And by the way, some of you have family members that have already said that to you, haven't they? Because they've caught you that way. And now you have to go and fix that. It's very hard to fix. That's why you must walk with integrity. You must absolutely not cross certain lines. The lines that you lay out and tell them, I'm not going to cross. Then you can't cross those lines. But I'm trying to maintain peace in my house. Yeah, but you're destroying all of your integrity and your witness. Yeshua did not say, at all costs, maintain peace in your house. He said, when you make a decision about me, sadly, in some houses, mother will be against daughter, father against son, sister against brother. That's going to happen. It's not his desire. It's just something that's going to happen. in some families. And so we have to be careful about turning into that easier looking path of compromise because it brings peace with your daughter or your son or your parents or your brother or your cousin or whatever it is, because they start lashing out at you because a lot of you, especially here in the South, half your families are pastors. I can't even tell you how many people I meet, they say, you don't understand, Rabbi, my two brothers, my sister, my father, his father, my cousin, they're all pastors. And they're just slaughtering me on this whole stuff. Then you're the light in that group. Be the light. Walk in that light. But do it in the context of the fruit. Patient, kind, gentle. Okay? Make sure you have all of that. And also have joy. Show them this is joyful. Don't always look like you're, you know, getting kicked around. But have joy in it. Be meek. All of those things. He says, verse 4, neither filthiness nor foolish talking nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather thanksgiving. So he's saying, not only should these things not be what's your reputation, but neither should filthiness nor foolish talking or coarse jesting, which are not fitting. So what are those things? Well, foolish talking in the Greek has a lot of a context of buffoonery. I don't know what the right word is to explain. Looking like a fool, you know, being like a joke almost. He says, often in the context of boasting. In other words, you talk big and then you look like a buffoon when it doesn't come out. He said, stop talking so big. There's nothing big about you. You're supposed to be a humble servant. And so this foolish talking has a lot of the context of it boastful. We're coming into the season where people will be posting all kinds of things about Christmas. And you'll see a lot of quote-unquote believers absolutely mocking and attacking anybody that would consider anything to do with that. Now, I will absolutely state for the record that there's nothing appropriate about celebrating that. However, there's also nothing appropriate about you attacking and mocking those that do. Because that's where they are. And that's kind of this foolish talk, I think, that's going on here in verse 2. Because now you're saying how great and wonderful and smart you are and how dumb everybody else is. Because you'll see people posting, what's wrong with you, you dumb, stupid Christians, blah, 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 blah. Wait a minute, you were them 5 minutes ago. Don't do that. Because they're not dumb and stupid. If anything, you're acting dumb and stupid by attacking them that way because you know that's not the reason they're there. They're there because Abba has not opened their eyes and ears just like you were before you understood it. So don't attack them as being dumb unless you want to say that you were just as dumb. But you couldn't see it just like they can't see it. And so that to me is part of what it's talking about here, foolish talking. Buffoonery, often in the context of boasting. There's also here in the same idea, this coarse jesting. Coarse jesting. So what is coarse jesting? It's often the context here is having a quick comeback. You know people like that no matter what you say, they got a quick comeback and they're got a little zinger for you, right? They're going to roast you and give you a quick zinger. He's saying, don't do that. He says, it's often this kind of a quick response that is either vulgar or causes harm or shame or embarrassment. Oh, but we're so proud of ourselves and how quick we are. Oh, I got that quick, sharp comeback, boy. And I'll tell you what, I used to be about the quickest around. That's nothing to brag about, though, because you know what I did? I either said something vulgar or I hurt somebody's feelings or I embarrassed them or I shamed them or just something else. So that's something to be proud of? To mock somebody in some way, because that's what coarse jesting is about. Coarse jesting is in some way causing harm, shame, or embarrassment in your fun. You want to make coarse jesting? Do it on yourself. Make fun of yourself. Don't make fun of anybody else. And actually, you shouldn't do that either, but you understand what I'm saying. You shouldn't even make fun of yourself. So he's talking about coarse jesting. He said, these are not fitting, but rather give thanks. He says, but rather give thanks. See, we have a big problem with appreciation. We really have a problem appreciating what we have and where we are and where we get to live and the things that we get to enjoy. And so appreciate what you have instead of mocking others who don't have. No foolish talk, no coarse jesting. Verse 5, for this you know, that no one who whores, nor an unclean one, nor one greedy of gain, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the reign of Messiah and Elohim. Wow. No one who whores, or unclean one, or greedy of gain, or an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom. So you want to be careful of the things that you say and the things that you do, because it may cost you your inheritance. Not because I say so, not because even Shaul said so, just because it's true. Because what's going on? In the biggest picture of them all, what's going on? The creator of the universe is watching you to decide whether or not he wants to live with you forever. And I don't think he wants to live with people that are filthy and foolish talking and coarse jesting. And do you want to live in a forever with people like that? Oh, but you don't mind it when you do it. You only mind it when they do it. Oh, I used to love that the best. That was the thing that really got me the best, is that, you know, as a teenager going into college, I was one of those guys that, boy, I could zing you right back as fast as lightning. But you know what? There were people that would zing me first, and if I gave them one back, oh, they would get so mad. Because most people, as the old saying goes, they can dish it out, but they can't take it. But you know what? You shouldn't have to take it, and you shouldn't be dishing it out. Why should we have to deal with that? Because some of you, we have this double standard. This is part of the hypocrisy that's in the heart, is that we all think I should be able to do it, but you can't. We're not thinking that consciously, but we do. But then when somebody does what we do, we get all upset. Wow, can you believe so-and-so did blah, blah, blah? And I say, why does that bother you? I watch you do that every day. And then they look at me like, how dare you? Well, no, how dare you get all upset because somebody does something to you that you do to everybody else too? Ah, but that's our thing. We have a very incredible, we live a life of double standard. Heart issue. I can do it, but you can't. You should let me do whatever I want, but I'm not going to let you do whatever you want. We see this playing out all the time. It's part of that heart issue. The heart is all messed up. We can't make correct decisions. Verse 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these, the wrath of Elohim comes upon the sons of disobedience. He's saying, let no one deceive you with empty words. Okay, what does it mean, this empty words? Well, in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1 through 3, we read this 3 or 4 times already. He says empty words have to do with doing things according to the course of this world. And that doing things according to the course of this world in Hasatan, that remember we read this already 2 or 3 times in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, where he says that this is the spirit that is working in the sons of disobedience. See, Paul's saying the same thing here from chapter 2 all the way to chapter 5. I mean, that shouldn't surprise you. This is a letter that he's written trying to make a point. His point is, stop acting like what you used to be. You're not Gentile anymore. Understand that that's a mindset. It's a heart that focuses on all these wrong things. Focuses on the world and Hasatan, and is not focused on the Creator and Torah. He says, if you do that, what are you doing? You're sons of disobedience. Now notice he doesn't say you're sons of sin or you're sons of, you're going to hell or this or other. He says you are disobedient. The opposite is obedience. See, the problem with Christianity today is it's teaching people that there's nothing to obey. More or less. I mean, I may be broad stroking a little bit, but you understand? It's saying the law was done away with. Well, that's the thing you were supposed to obey. And so you can't be called sons of disobedience when there's nothing to obey anymore. So now, I guess that all got wiped out, but wait a minute, Yeshua's already been dead and resurrected when Paul's writing this. So I guess whatever Yeshua did didn't change the fact that we could still be called sons of disobedience, which looks like in this verse is not something you want to be called. So you might want to figure out what it is you're supposed to obey. So that you're not disobeying, which is why I went back to chapter 2 and verse 1. And verse 2, it says, you used to walk according to the course of the world, the way that the world works, the course or the path of the world. And in doing so, he said, this is the spirit that is working in the sons of disobedience. The spirit, what is the spirit? The fullness of the approach, the intent, the intrinsic nature of the world is functioning in those that disobey. Because in disobedience is a fruit or a manifestation of that mindset and that heart. And he's saying, stop. He says in verse 17, in chapter 4, we were told, you need to no longer walk as you did when you were Gentile. When you were in darkness and when you were separate from the covenants and you didn't know what you were doing and you were just living life the way you thought everybody else was living it. He says, don't do that anymore, because that was the lifestyle of those. Well, hold on, let me rephrase myself. You were not being disobedient when you didn't know there was something to obey. But now that you do, which is what he's talking about, if you continue to walk as a Gentile, now you're being disobedient. So what's the spirit of disobedience? The insistence on maintaining your Gentile behaviors while claiming to be a believer. Stop claiming you're a believer, that you're following Yeshua, that you're imitating Yeshua, and doing things Yeshua never did. He never ate unclean. He never observed pagan holidays. He never did these things that you want to still do. This is where I'm very much at odds with a lot of these ministries out there that are quote-unquote messianic or Hebrew roots that want to claim that somehow the Jew has to keep the Torah and the Gentile could keep doing anything they were doing. And yet somehow they're supposed to be one in Messiah. Really? That sounds like confusion in Messiah. That's not one in Messiah. But yet this bilateral ecclesiology nonsense is being put out there over and over. You know what this is? It's let no one deceive you with empty words. These are empty words because they don't bear actual fruit of usefulness. It's they're empty because they're useless. They don't actually get you where you want to go. He says, let no one deceive you with these empty words, because these empty words are the ones that come up, otherwise the wrath will come upon you because you'll be a disobedient son. Because you'll allow the empty words to cause you to disobey. So we're looking for empty words that cause disobedience. I don't know. What about this Melchizedekian thing that's out there right now? Oh, that teaching is causing an awful lot of people to think it's okay to disobey some of the Torah. See, those are empty words. Be careful of empty words. What have I told you? I've told you, be a maximalist, not a minimalist. If it turns out some of what you've done you didn't have to do, guess what? No harm, no foul. But if you didn't do some of the stuff you were supposed to do because you bought into empty words, you're going to be in trouble. Because it says wrath. It says because of these, the wrath of Elohim comes upon the sons of disobedience. It's not because of the empty words, is because you have been deceived. You bought into the empty words. And he's specifically talking to people that should know better. So do not attack all your friends and family members who are not keeping the commandments, because they're not the ones that are deceived by the empty words in this category. They've been deceived as a whole. In other words, they've never known there was a right way to go. They haven't been given the eyes to see, ears to hear, and the heart to receive. But until then, leave them alone. But now for you, that's who Paul is talking to here. Paul is, remember, he's talking to the set apart ones, chapter 1 and verse 1, right? To the set apart ones who are in Ephesus and the true to Messiah Yeshua, okay? He's talking to ones who should know better. So those people who should know better, he's saying, you, if you still are insisting, go back to chapter 4 and verse 17, they're still walking in the Gentile mindset. He says, no longer walk as the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. If you're going to keep walking as a Gentile, you are actually going to receive the wrath of Elohim, which comes upon you as a disobedient son. You got to let that stuff go. But you know what? Until you get the heart right, you're not going to let it go. It's a heart issue. It's a heart issue. And so what happens is these empty words appeal to your heart, because it appeals to what you really do or don't want to do. So when you hear these empty words, you go, I like that better, because that tells me I don't have to do these things over here that I really didn't want to do anyway. And again, I promise you, if you did more than you had to, you will get into zero trouble. Any of you ever in your life did more than what was expected and it got you in trouble? Nobody, right? When you went above and beyond what was expected, did you get in trouble? No. Did you ever do less than what was expected and get in trouble? At least every time you got caught. Thing is, Abba sees it all. You're going to get caught. He already knows. He knows it's a heart issue. Look, all that I'm teaching you for this 55 parts goes back to Deuteronomy 8:2. You're going through a test. In Deuteronomy 8:2, it says that he's having you walk this out through your wilderness. In the case, he was talking about Israel coming out of the desert for the 40 years that they were in, but for whatever your life is, to test and to know and to prove whether it's your heart is to keep his commandments or not. Is it in your heart to obey? That's the whole point of this physical, fleshly life. And by the way, it's not going to work unless he humbles you first, which is why in Deuteronomy 8:2, it starts off with, to humble you, he led you through the wilderness so that you suffer and that you humbled and that you... Now, he says that you didn't starve and your clothes didn't wear out, but he led you through a place that was challenging so that he can have you be humble and he could see what was in your heart. Because you know what? When you have, if I just gave you everything you ever wanted, how would I ever know what's in your heart? You'd just be a spoiled brat, right? We all know people that are spoiled brats. And so there would be no way to know what's really in your heart. By the way, that's what HaSatan said about Job. He said, well, I can't do anything with him. You give him everything. And Yahweh said, well, that's really not why he behaves this way. And I'll prove it to you. Take away all that stuff and see. We'll see for sure what's in his heart. And by the way, when you suffer loss, maybe you have to realize you're just going through a Deuteronomy 8:2 test where he's taking away some things so you can really see what's going on in your heart. And by the way, he may do with you like he did with Job and give you twice back what he allowed to be taken. If you pass the test. If you pass the test. So continuing here, he says, look, let no one deceive you then with the empty words, because the empty words lead to disobedience, and that brings on the wrath of Elohim upon the sons of disobedience. He says, therefore, do not become partakers with who? With the ones who are being disobedient. Don't do what they do. Remember, we were told to imitate the light, to imitate Messiah, imitate Elohim. He's saying, when it says, do not do these things that he read in verse 3 and verse 4, he says, because you know what? Yeshua never did them. So you're not imitating those things. He says, let no one deceive you. And how are they deceiving you? They're trying to convince you that Yeshua did things he never did or was okay with things that he was never okay with. And you hear this from the pulpits, not just on Sunday. You hear it on Saturday too. You hear this in Messianic congregations. You hear this in other Saturday-keeping congregations. You hear it in Adventist congregations, in Seventh-day Church of God congregations, in split-offs of the Worldwide Church of God congregations. All the congregations that in some way are not teaching the fullness of Torah, you are still hearing this because they're not teaching the full part. And so we are here to embrace the fullness that is Messiah. Stop carving off little pieces and saying, I don't like this, I don't want this. Or listening to teachers who are trying to convince you with their empty words that you don't need that stuff. Verse 8. Okay, verse 8. He says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Master. Walk as children of light. So that goes back to John 8, right? He says, I am the light of the world. He says, he who follows me shall by no means walk in darkness, but possess the light of life. He says in John 12, we read this, walk in the light so that you become sons of light. This is exactly what Paul's talking about, perfectly consistent with what Yeshua said in John. He says, walk as children of light. Verse 9, for the fruit of the Spirit, okay, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is well-pleasing to the Master. So verse 8 started tying it all together, everything that was from like chapter 2 all the way to here, saying, look, walk in the light. Stop being in darkness. You were once in darkness, but now you're not that anymore. Well, if you're not, stop acting like you still are. It's just, you know, if you made a choice, okay, and I have to tell you, in my life, it was a very quick contrast because I was in my early 20s. I lived in New York. I was going to college or just out of college and living in the world, and I had the typical 20-something-year-old, 20-year-old mouth. I did. And if you go into the bigger cities and you hear the way people talk, every other sentence, or at least every sentence, has some sort of expletive in it or something. I had that mouth. And when I came to believe in the truth, in the Torah and Yeshua, my mouth changed. And everybody around me was very clearly aware, what in the world happened? Because no longer did I sound like me. When you change from darkness to light, was it evident to anybody? Could anybody notice any difference? Did you stop doing some things that people knew you always used to do and start doing things you never used to do? Was there any evidence to people, if they looked at you, that you were different than you used to be? Isn't that what he's talking about here? He says, look, you were once A, you're now B. Stop acting like you're still A. You're not darkness anymore. You're not walking in the futility of your mind. You're not walking as the world walked when you were in the world. Gentile simply means everybody not in covenant. Okay? There's Israel and there's Gentiles. There's Israel and there's the everybody else's. Gentile is simply a word to call them. That's a word for everybody else's. It's not a negative word. It's not an insulting word. It simply means everybody outside the camp. But this whole thing is all about, Paul's always about telling you that you can't make the change from outside the camp to inside the camp. But you can't come inside the camp and still act like you were when you're outside the camp. If you do, we'll kick you right back out. Because that behavior is okay out there. It's not okay in here. And so what Paul's trying to appeal, obviously, to the Ephesians is that they were clearly having a problem with letting go of the old man, the old way of life, and walking in this new way of life. I mean, that seems to be the really big problem here. He says, look, in verse chapter 4, and this was still in Ephesians here, chapter 4, he says, if indeed you have heard, verse 21. Well, first of all, he says in verse 20, you've not learned, so Messiah. If indeed you have heard him and were taught by him as the truth is in Yeshua, then you put off with regard to your former way of life, the old man being corrupted. That's the whole point of this whole letter. It's, hey, guys, you made a decision. You made a choice. Your eyes were opened. Your ears were opened. Stop acting like you're still back where you were. Because that decision, that commitment has fruit supposed to be attached to it, a behavior, a lifestyle. That's why he talks about walk in love as Messiah also loved us. Walk as he walked. Imitate him. And we need to examine ourselves and say, you know what? How much of me is still the old me? How much of me has not changed? Still doesn't look at all like Yeshua. Is still walking in that darkness and not walking in light. How much of me is still there? He's saying, don't do that. He's saying, look, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Master. Walk as children of light. There's that walk again. In other words, walk is your lifestyle. Live your life as children. That's what the word walk means there. How you live your life. Live your life as children of light, children of Torah, children of Yeshua, children of the truth. He says, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth. The fruit of the fullness of how Yahweh intended it, the fruit of the intrinsic nature of the Creator is all in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. Let's get away from that ethereal, ewy-gooey, what spirit means. It simply means the intrinsic nature. Right now, we see a lot of people in this country running around in the spirit of fear. So what does it mean? They all have like a million spirits called fear possessing all these people? That's ridiculous. Their intrinsic mindset and approach and nature is now one of fear. In other words, that's the dominating mindset. It's the dominating behavior is coming out of that mindset. What he's saying here is, look, the fruit of the dominant total mindset of the Creator is in all goodness and righteousness and truth. And if you want that spirit, he says, you know how you get it? By proving what is well-pleasing to the Master. That's our job. You want to know what your job is? Prove what is well-pleasing to the Master, then walk in it. Don't just prove it. A lot of us are pretty good at proving things, and then we just don't do anything with it. You know, I could ask the question, how many of you know somebody that knows something they need to do to change something in their life, they know exactly what to do, how to do it, and everything else, and they're not doing it? And every hand would go up because you know somebody, but you're forgetting to think about you. Because you're going to think about your husband, your wife, your brother, your sister, your cousin, your coworker, your best friend, but realize you are that person first. You know things that you need to do and change and should be doing and changing right away that you're still not doing. You got to go through the process of proving what is well-pleasing to the Master, and then you got to walk in it. And then you got to walk in it. That's the whole key, all right? The whole key is that the fruit of walking in the Spirit, the fullness of how Yahweh intended it to be walked, See, I'm going to paraphrase that verse again, verse 9. The fruit of walking in the Spirit, the fullness of how Yahweh intended it to be walked, is goodness, righteousness, and truth. That's the way I read it. You don't have to agree. Then we get to verse 10. He says, proving what is well-pleasing to the Master. Now, this is picking up on the end of verse 8. He says, you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Master. Walk as children of light. And then we drop to verse 10, proving what is well-pleasing to the Master. That's how you walk as children of light. So in my verse, in my version of the scriptures here, it kind of puts a little hyphen between the end of verse 8 and the end of verse 9. It's that little piece in the middle, this idea of the fruit of the Spirit, is it all goodness and righteousness and truth? It's kind of a parenthetical thought in the middle of that. But if you pop that out for a second, you can see the flow. You were once darkness, but now you are light in the Master. Walk as children of light, proving what is well-pleasing to the Master. That's how you do it. So verse 9 is telling you that the fruit of walking in the Spirit of the fullness of how Yahweh intended it to be, it walked as goodness, righteousness, and truth. I mean, it's not that complicated. To walk as children of light is accomplished. The way that this is accomplished is through proving and doing what is well-pleasing to the Master. Proving and doing what is well-pleasing to the Master. Verse 11. He says, and have no fellowship with the fruitless works of darkness, but rather reprove them. Okay, this is where people get in all kinds of trouble. Let's talk about this. Have no fellowship with. Okay, the Greek there means to do not share company with or co-participate in the fruitless works of darkness. Now notice what it's talking about here. It's talking about the fruitless works, not the people necessarily. But if the people are going to live a lifestyle that's all they're bearing, then you need to avoid the people. But he's saying here, the most important thing is that we are not sharing company with or participating in the fruitless works. So this isn't to say you need to cut off everybody that's not Torah observant. It means that you don't spend time with them while they're doing fruitless works of darkness. No, you don't go to grandma's house for Christmas dinner. No, you don't go out to the bar and hang out and do the things in the bar that your friends used to do. No, you don't. You know what I'm saying? No, you don't get caught in that off-color conversation by the water cooler at work. No, you don't. Keep filling in the blanks. He says, don't do. These things are not fitting. The foolish talking, the coarse jesting, the unclean acts, the whoring, the greedy gain, the idolatry, all these other things. Don't even spend time with others when they're doing these things. That's not to say you can never spend time with your friends and your family, because you're also supposed to be a light to them. But when they, remember, it's talking about do not have fellowship with the fruitless works. So this is about the works of darkness. When they're working out, doing these things that are darkness, then you need to say, check please, and go ahead and leave, okay? Because you cannot be in company with that, let alone participating. I don't know. Maybe you see the verse differently, but that's how I see it. It says, have no fellowship with the fruitless works of darkness, but rather reprove them. We'll talk about the reproving part also, because people really get in trouble with this piece. But first, let me make sure. Are we all clear on that we are not to share company with or co-participate in fruitless works of darkness when that is what's going on? When that is not going on, yes, you can still be with your brother and your sister and your parents and your cousins and your friends and everything else. But as soon as it heads in that darkness direction, you need to exit stage left. Okay? Everybody who remembers Snagglepuss, right? Okay? You need to just say, I can't do this. I'll talk to you later. And do it with the fruit of the Spirit, though. Don't judge them. Don't let them feel judged. You use judgment to say, I can't do this. I'll see you tomorrow. All right? Everybody says, hey, we're all going out to do this, this, and this. And you're like, that's okay. I'll pass. I'll see you tomorrow. All right? Now, what about this reproving? It says to reprove, but rather reprove them. Okay, first of all, we have to figure out who the them is. You're reproving the people or reproving the works of darkness? So let's be careful with that. So here in the Greek, the word reprove is, in my opinion anyway, is better translated to prove to be wrong. This is best accomplished through the witness of your walk, to prove it to be wrong. In other words, the fruitless works of darkness. So they think that what they're doing is going to bear all kinds of good fruit. They're going to have a great time. It's going to bring them whatever it is they're hoping to gain out of it. And you reprove it by saying, you know what, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to show you that through my walk, it bears better fruit. Okay, so when we see reproof, we sometimes think of it as the word of that you actually go and correct somebody. You tell them, you better not be doing, you shouldn't do. Don't you know how wrong that is? Blah, blah, blah. That's not what the word is actually means here. Okay? It really has more of an understanding of proving to be wrong in some way, demonstrating that it's wrong, demonstrating that it doesn't work, demonstrating that it doesn't bear the right fruit. So this is not as Christian, and I know a lot of you know Christians that do this, and Messianics that do this. They think this is license to go and correct everybody. Haven't you all experienced that and seen that? That is not, in my opinion, what this is saying. It says, have no fellowship with the fruitless works of darkness, but rather approve the fruitless works of darkness, not the people. Because the people aren't ready to hear that, or they wouldn't be doing the fruitless works of darkness. What you're going to do is prove them to be wrong. I don't mean prove them to be wrong by writing a paper and sending them 75 emails. I mean, live your life. Don't just say, here, let me prove to you why that's wrong. Here, see this verse? No, that's not what it's talking about. Live your life. This is all about your walk. Verse 2 of chapter 5 was walk in love. Other places says, don't walk as you used to walk. Don't walk in the Gentile mindset. Don't walk, don't walk, don't walk. It's all about how you walk. Your lifestyle, your behavior of your life. So what do? We show that our way of walking, the life of Yeshua, imitating Yeshua, bears different fruit and therefore shows the other way to be wrong. Does that make any sense to anybody? Okay, so let's be careful. It's not a verse giving everybody instruction to go ahead and correct everybody that you know. That's not the context of what's being talked about here. By the way, if anything, all of this is in the context of Paul instructing and reproving you. Telling you what you need to be doing and not doing. He's never telling you to go worry about everybody else. He's saying you need to put that oxygen mask on yourself first. He says, but rather reprove through your lifestyle that the works of darkness bear no good fruit. Listen, verse 12, for it is a shame even to speak of what is done by them in secret. But all matters being reproved, okay, now listen, all matters, all being reproved are manifested by the light, for whatever is manifested is light. This is where we're going to really get the clarity here. All matters having been proved to be wrong by our own experience through our walk or through our observation of the fruit of the walk of others are manifested or made apparent when compared to the fruit of walking through or in accordance with the light. Okay? In other words, because this verse could be a little confusing, it says, all matters being reproved are manifested by the light and whatever is manifested is light. Because Christians may say, well, whatever is manifested, that's automatically light. Let's understand, let's break this down into more words in English. All matters having been reproved or been proved to be wrong by either our own experience or through the observation of the fruit of the experience of others who are walking out the Torah, okay, through their walk or our walk. So you're either going to have proved it wrong by your own experience or by watching others. Because I tell you what, it's better to learn from watching others and doing it yourself if you can because it's a lot less painful. Learn the lessons from others who could say, you know what, I've already done that walk, and I could tell you that doesn't go well. By the way, that's part of why we have these examples in Scripture. You know, Paul says, all this stuff was written so that you can learn from other people's experiences so you don't have to do it yourself. Now, I'm not saying you don't have to walk out Torah. I'm saying you don't have to go make the mistakes and learn from the mistakes when you can see other people already did it. I mean, if you watch me walk up to something and I touch it, I'm like, ah! And my hand hurts and I burn myself or something, you don't need to go do the same thing to have learned what I just learned. He says, but all matters having been proved to be wrong by our own experience through our walk or through our observation of the fruit of other people's walk are then manifested or made apparent when compared to the fruit of walking through and in accordance to the light. So in other words, when you're looking at the walk, you're looking at someone's walk, whether it's right or wrong, you're either walking this out or you're looking at someone else's walk. When you compare that to the light, what gets manifested is the truth. And then if what you're doing and what the light is match, then what you have is light. Again, he says, all matters being shown to be wrong or right or wrong by being reproved are manifested by light. In other words, by comparison to the light, you get to know what's right and what's wrong. Because you're comparing also the fruit of walking in darkness and walking in light. He says, so whatever is manifested or made apparent is light. See, when you're walking your life, all of you have this experience, I know to some degree. You were living life. You came to find out about the correct way to live life. You started making adjustments, and guess what you saw? Different fruit. And what was manifested? Light. It became, in other words, you were enlightened. It became obvious to you. It became apparent to you that, that's another way for manifest. It means to be made apparent. Okay, it was manifested or made apparent to you that, hey, this didn't really work and doesn't work. This other thing really does. See, look, and I've often made this statement. I don't want to sound like a blaspheming non-believer or something. Okay? But I don't care what you believe about this book, whether you believe in God or not or any of those kinds of things, Yahweh, whatever, it doesn't matter to me. I can absolutely prove to you as manifested or made apparent that it works. Does that matter to anybody? In other words, I had life for 20-something years with nothing, living the world. Now, I didn't live the world in a horrible way necessarily. I was raised with certain values and stuff. But I mean, I lived without the Torah for the most part. Then I lived with the Torah for a number of years. And so I saw what that was like, what was manifest, what the fruit was. Okay? So that was for about almost 20 years. And then I had a 7-year journey where I was back out without all of this stuff again. That's all public. Everybody knows about that. And I know what that fruit was like for 7 years. And now I'm back. And now I've been back for six years plus. And there's no doubt to compare the fruit. The fruit when I was out was the same both times. The fruit being in is the same both times. Amen? So you go ahead if you want and try and live back out there and see if the, you know, some of you are emailing me or posting things on Facebook and they're like, well, I don't understand why my life is so blah, 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 because you're still walking the old way of life. I know some of you. I know what you're doing. And then you're shocked that all the stuff is still messed up in your life. Well, you're still acting like you did before in the other lifestyle, in the other walk. Just claiming, see, this is the huge fallacy of Christianity, where Christianity says somehow just claiming that you believe Messiah is Messiah changes everything. It changes nothing unless you let it be the motivator to change everything. Just believing in him changes nothing if you keep doing all the things you did. So, but somehow people act surprised, like, well, I don't understand why my life is still in the pit. Why is it still such a mess? Well, because you're still doing all the same things you used to do. You haven't changed. Paul's talking about you got to realize that if you don't change, you're going to keep reaping what goes with that behavior or lifestyle. One lifestyle leads to wrath because you're disobedient. The other lifestyle leads to reward because you're obedient. It's not really, by the way, that's how every parent works. Every parent tells their child, if you disobey, I'm going to punish you. Ah, that's wrath. If you behave really nicely, I'm going to reward you. Why do we think our heavenly Father, right, parent, the Creator, is any different? He says everywhere in his word that's it. It's his good pleasure to give you rewards when you're a good and faithful servant, when you're a son of Elohim, living and doing what's well-pleasing in his sight. But this is all about that. So he says all matters are basically shown to be right or wrong when they're manifested when compared to the light. And then you understand really what the difference is when you compare it to the light. And what is made apparent is light. In other words, through the comparison, it becomes really apparent what's the difference. See, but people will use this verse and say, well, whatever is manifested, that means that it's okay. No, that's not what it's talking about. It's saying, look, through this process, it becomes apparent what is light and what is not light. That's all he's saying. And that, by the way, is completely consistent with what he said for 3 chapters here. Isn't it? Isn't this what he's been saying in chapter 2 and 3 and 4 up to this point? And all of chapter 5 up to this point. So we have to understand and embrace that. So then we get to verse 14. He says, that is why he says, wake up, you who sleep, and arise from the dead, and Messiah shall shine on you. So let's take this into a physical metaphor. He's saying, wake up from this dead lifestyle. Chapter 2 and verse 1 said, you were dead in trespasses. Let's not go to the resurrection here. Let's just do it in the physical life right now. He says, wake up, you who sleep. You're walking around like you're in a dead stupor, and arise from the dead, and Messiah shall shine on you. The truth, the light, the Torah, the way, all of that stuff will shine on you. He says, see then that you walk exactly, not as unwise, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are wicked. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the desire of Elohim is. He says, see then that you walk exactly. That word also can be understood as diligently and circumspectly. In other words, examining and being aware of what's going on. Walk understanding the realities of the world you live in, and also understanding yourself, what you are likely and capable of going towards, what tempts you, what draws you, where your weaknesses are. That's being circumspect in understanding these things, but not as unwise. Now, why would you be unwise? Well, if you listen to all of this and ignore it, that's not showing any wisdom at all. Paul's giving you tremendous wisdom here. He's giving you tremendous insight into you. Forget about just giving you tremendous insight into Torah. Paul is talking about you. He's reading your mail and getting right into your face and meddling with you, saying, I know what you are. And he's saying, look, if you're not going to take wisdom, well, he says, then do not be foolish, verse 17, but understand what the desire is. Don't be foolish. Refusing to accept wisdom when it's offered is foolishness. He says, don't be foolish. Because in this way, when we are wise and we're circumspect and we're walking exactly, in this way, we redeem the time. See, some of you out there listening didn't come to this understanding until you were 50 or 55 or 60 or 65, etc. And you're thinking, oh, Abba, why did you do this? Why didn't you give me more years? You know what? If you walk wisely, you redeem the time. You don't need a lot of years. You need to make use of what you have. Stop wasting the time. That's the word here. That's the message. But in doing these things, you actually redeem the time. So don't be foolish, but understand what the desire of Yahweh is. By the way, this word for foolish, and you're not going to like this, but I'm going to just read what the Greek gives you the understanding. It has the understanding of mindless, stupid, ignorant, egotistic. I like that one because I think most people make the same foolishness because they think they know better. I'm smart. I don't need anybody to tell me. I can figure this all out for myself. It's the ego that's the biggest anti-Torah, anti-Yeshua. It's your own ego that's the biggest problem, that's self-sovereignty. It says the foolishness is mindless, stupid, ignorant, egotistic, rash, or unbelieving. We make these rash decisions. The ego is driving it. We do things out of ignorance. Sometimes you do things just because it's just plain stupid because we just want what we want, what we want. It's just dumb. And it's mindless. We're not thinking it through. He says, don't be mindless, stupid, ignorant, egotistic, rash, or unbelieving. He says, don't be that way. He says, understand what the desire of Yahweh is. Imitate Yeshua. Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you that was also in Yeshua. In other words, the way he saw the world, the way he thought, the way he approached things, let that be in you. The only way to do that is to subjugate you. You're going to have to quiet your own voice in your own head. You're going to have to get off that self-sovereign throne. I talk about this every week. You know why? Because you are the biggest problem you have. All of you want to tell me, you don't understand, my husband and my wife, my kids, my this is my biggest problem. No, you are. There's no doubt. The biggest problem that you have is you. That's what Paul's saying here. You are your own biggest problem. You get you straightened out, everything else will work out just fine, because then if it doesn't, you'll approach it correctly. You'll handle it better. You'll understand that you trust Yahweh to deal with those issues and those matters. But you're not ready to do that yet because you still haven't gotten you under control. And that's really where we're having this breakdown. Okay? That's really where we're having this breakdown. And he finishes off by saying, and do not be drunk with wine or in loose behavior, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to each other in psalms and songs of praise and spiritual songs, singing and striking the strings in your heart to the Master, giving thanks always for all to Elohim the Father in the name of our Master Yeshua, subjecting yourselves to each other in the fear of Elohim. That's the approach. That's the approach. He wants us to strike the strings in our heart to the Master, not to yourself. Giving thanks always for all to Elohim the Father in the name of the Master Yeshua. This is really important. Now, we don't have time, but I was going to continue. I may just do that next week in showing how verses 22 through the end uses the literal and the metaphor of the husband and wife to get to verse 32 that says, this is a great secret, but I'm not speaking about husbands and wives. I'm speaking about the relationship between Messiah and the congregation. And understanding how everything from chapter 2 all the way through here is going to be played out in the metaphor and the literal of a husband and wife, and also in congregants with the assembly, with the Master. And so perhaps we'll pick that up next week. I only hesitate because I don't want to get too heavy into the husband and wife thing without taking that into a whole separate teaching. But just realize, if you're reading it yourself, in case I don't cover it, that this rest of it here is not a separate thing that all of a sudden Paul went off onto and said, okay, enough of that, now let's talk about marriage. No, everything that he's talking about right here is built on what we read from chapter 2 to this point. Realize that that's what it's about. And it really, again, has to do with understanding the relationships and the roles of vertical leadership. Okay, because he compares the wives and the husbands to their roles, that when at some point in your life, you're going to have an authority position, and other points, you're going to have to be a submissive person to an authority, and understanding how those roles are supposed to look. He uses the metaphor of husbands and wives. But guess what? If you're a husband, you still have to understand how to be a wife, because that role or that approach is still what you have in the assembly when you're under another authority. And the wife has to understand how to be a husband because she's got to deal with her children or other places where she may have authority. So it's about positions of authority, and you have to understand both directions. Okay? And everybody must function in both directions. You're going to have those that you are subject to and those who are subject to you. And what did you just read in that last verse that I read in verse 21? Subjecting yourselves to each other in the awe and respect and reverence and fear of Elohim. That's the context of all this. And I hope we're embracing it. Let's go ahead and pray. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, Father, we come before you. And Father, you're getting our attention. I hope and pray that you're getting everyone's attention to understand what we need to do in our own hearts and in our own minds, so that we can become children of obedience and not sons of disobedience. Father, that you would continue the work in us that you've started, that you would continue to give us patient, loving correction, that you would give us the space and the time and the opportunities to actually measure things up against the measurement of that which is light, so that it would be made manifest or made obvious what is light and what is darkness. Father, help us to have the clarity with more understanding and wisdom and discernment to know what is of you and what is not. What is our egotistic and our self-sovereign ways of getting in the way? What is the worldly stuff that is still the futility of the old lifestyle not being ended? Where is it that we are still walking in darkness? Father, help us to see so that we can change our path to totally walk in the light. So, Father, we come to you asking and actually pleading, Father, because of our desire and our heart and our love truly is for you and to spend forever with you, knowing that we're not going to get there if we don't get these things figured out and corrected so that we can, because you want to spend forever with people whose hearts are for you, whose hearts are completely and fully subjected to you, committed to you, loving you, appreciating you, and wanting to be like you. So, Father, we thank you for the opportunity. We thank you for all that you do. We give thanks to you always for all that you do in the name of our Master, as I said in verse 20 we read, giving thanks always for all to you, Father, in the name of our Master Yeshua. And together we say, Amen, Amen.